It's the next year green on podtech.net. I'm Matt Kelly. I'm joined here today by Chelsea Sexton of Who Killed the Electric Car fame. Are you seeing what you need to see with the Volt to know that it's coming, not just believe that it's coming, but to know that it's coming?
So far I am. And part of it is seeing the public actions, and part of it is knowing the people involved and having known them for several years. And I have as much faith in the people as I do in the actions I'm seeing. And I think what GM has bought themselves right now is a little bit of grace. A lot happens between concept and showroom, and a lot can still happen, and there are still a couple of years between now and when they want to get that car on the road. So there's no guarantee. There's a saying that it's not here till you see it on a truck in your driveway.
Right.
And so we don't, you know, we hesitate, you know, and we always say, you know, I'll judge them not by what they say, but what they do. And so far, I think they're on track.
Mm-hmm.
And
it takes a long time to bring a car from concept to a showroom.
Absolutely.
And I don't think, even among very committed advocates, that they understand that. They think, oh, you know, if we got back to our World War II, you know,
right,
production, it could be here. And
Manhattan Project.
Exactly.
It'll be here in 6 months.
And yet they think we are in that mentality,
right,
with what's going on with our national security being,
right,
you know, so heavily dependent on foreign oil and whatnot.
Right.
But it's a different paradigm.
And there is a little bit of that where, even I think in certain cases, automakers could move faster than they choose to at times. I think that based on a traditional car program, GM has actually moved rather quickly on this one. And the fact that the Volt program didn't exist, you know, a year and a half ago,
mm-hmm,
really didn't. I mean, it was only a year between when they decided to do it and when they announced it,
mm-hmm,
in Detroit. And a lot of that has been, I think, the result of a lot of the grassroots and consumer effort. I think it's an amazing indication. It's one of the first times that we have seen a car program as a direct result of consumer interest.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows that the industry is turning around. It's no longer quite so much. It's still there. We're going to build what we want. We're going to convince you that you want it. And as long as you buy what we're making, we're not going to make anything else. And, you know, I think the domestic manufacturers are learning they can't do that anymore because people aren't buying what they've been making in such numbers. And so they're trying to be more responsive.
Mm.
And that, in turn, puts more responsibility on the consumers to ask for what they want.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just say, I don't want a Suburban. You have to tell them what you do want.
I see that, though, across the spectrum, not just relating to cars, actually,
mm-hmm,
that the consumer is having... Finally, the consumer's coming into their own, if you will,
right,
across
starting
the board.
To.
Yeah,
starting to. And we spend a lot of time trying to teach consumers what's possible, but also to get them to ask for it.
Mm.
You know, it's not enough just not to buy a new car. You have to not buy a new car and tell them what you do want to buy. Here's when I will come back to you as a company. And, you know, part of what we tried to convey in the film was that we are all in this together. It is a very complicated story. There were lots of suspects, lots of layers, but none of them are beyond redemption. And we have a large capacity for forgiveness as a society, especially when, you know, a sincere effort is coupled with a little bit of humility. And there are people, like certain, you know, enthusiasts, as they tend to be called, who will never forgive GM,
mm,
especially without that really blatant apology. They want to see, you know, Wagner, lots of somebody out there say, I'm sorry, okay? You know?
And yet, Wagner has admitted that it was probably the single biggest mistake that he made in,
right,
his tenure, because Rick was the one who actually did kill the electric
car. It was
car,
on
if
his watch,
that.
Yes, mm-hmm, yes. And, you know, I think a lot of people were part of the killing of it,
mm-hmm,
or the, you know, however you want to put that. But certainly it was on his watch, and he did admit that.
It's interesting. I had an interview with Theodore Bone of,
mm-hmm,
Argonne National Laboratories, and he remarks to say, the electric car isn't dead. Here's one right here.
Right.
Here's one right here. You know, at Hybrid Fest in,
right,
in Madison. The impact and the EV1 may be dead, but the electric vehicle,
right,
is not dead.
Well, and that was something as well that we, you know, struggled with in the film of saying it's dead and yet it's not. And I think what's important in the message of it, and if you watch the film and see the epilogue, it's clear that we didn't think the technology is dead. And that's what's important. You can't,
mm-hmm,
kill a technology. Certainly certain cars were killed, but you can't kill a technology. And that was, it's not a film about a car. I mean,
mm,
it was an interesting challenge to make the film the hero, I mean, the car the hero of the film. And how do you get people to sort,
mm,
of emotionally vote for a car. But it wasn't really a film about a car. It was a film about ideas. Mm. And, you know.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the film, and I'm glad that we've kind of morphed here to with our discussion. First of all, Chris Payne, the director, was an EV1 lessee.
Right.
And the producer of it was as well. And that probably spurred their interest in making the film.
Yes. I mean, it started actually as just all of us trying to get the story told. What was bizarre in the middle of a seemingly truth is stranger than fiction story was that no one would tell it.
Mm.
We were all sitting there saying, well, wait a minute, where's 60 Minutes? Where's Frontline? Where's the LA Times? Anybody?
Mm-hmm.
And even if you think we're the crazy ones in the story, it's a really interesting story.
Yeah.
And we couldn't get anyone to tell it. And so we ended up staging that funeral,
yes.
That really nutty funeral that opens the film, and we thought it's such an only in LA thing. Procession, and you have eulogies, and a rabbi, and all of these things at a cemetery. The media will cover it. And they did a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit. And the story that was told was electric car drivers bid fond farewell to their electric cars and get ready for fuel cells. That's not the story. We don't want fuel cells. That's not where this is going. And so Chris did decide, you know what, I'm just going to try to make this myself. And he got, you know, spent a bunch of his own money and made a trailer and started shopping it around. And, you know, we kept urging him toward a particular filmmaker that would help him. And he finally did. He hooked up with Dean Devlin, who is known for making really small films like The Patriot and Independence Day and Godzilla, but who was an EV1 driver and whose father was one of my very first EV1 drivers and had a lot of passion for the technology. I mean, he named his film companies Electric Entertainment and Voltage Productions after the car. You know, when he went off and made The Patriot with Mel Gibson, Mel came back wanting a car, and so I ended up with all these guys as customers. And so Chris and Dean got together, decided to do it over the course of a few years. But we thought, we're going to burn copies for our parents and move on with our lives. I mean, it's not the kind of thing where we thought it would hit the big screen. And you know, even with someone like Dean involved, there is no guarantee.
Right, right.
And so, you know, we didn't necessarily expect it to go anywhere.
And Sony
been
picked
a ride.
It up. And
yeah.
And I'm also amazed in a sense that the movie, as well as the car and its demise, is very recent history. Here we are in 2007. This story really, I won't say ended, but you know, the arc of the tragedy,
sure,
if you will, was really 2004, 2005.
Yeah.
Very recent.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, it did.
The vehicle came out in the early
out.
90s, but, you know.
Right, well, yeah, I mean, the first concept came out in 1990. The vehicle itself came out about 10 years ago in the end of 96.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the program lasted for 5 or 6 years. And shortly
after it ended.
So that goes
to 2001?
Yeah, sure,
so.
I mean, you know, it was more like 2003 maybe that
yeah.
Chris decided he wanted to make this and spent a few years doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And originally it started out to be something very different. I mean, with a documentary, you never know where it's going to take you.
Uh-huh.
And it was supposed to be a comedy. I was never supposed to be in it. I mean, all of these things were supposed to be very different about it. You wanted very sort of Roger Rabbit-y and to tell the story, but to do it in a funny way. And then there was this sort of fateful unfolding of the destruction. And we started to get the pictures of the crushed cars and the vigil happened. And none of these things were on the radar screen when he started. And so it took a very different direction than, you know, what he had originally intended. And that was part of the journey, too. And it lasted through spring of 05, the story and the vigil and all of that.
Mm.
And then the film just came out a year ago, in summer of 06.
Are you surprised at the success of the film and that it continues to generate the response that it does?
Yeah.
Most, you know, documentaries or even, you know, major theatrical releases don't have such a shelf life to them.
That has been surprising, for sure. I mean, especially since, you know, we spent so long, well, A, trying to keep the story from needing to be told, but then to get it told and came up against such walls that I think every time we show up and there's an audience sitting there wanting to hear it, it's an amazing thing. I mean, you still get goosebumps from it. And so it's been really heartening to see this sort of grassroots roll out, and it still goes, and I still go to screenings, and colleges are getting on board, and all these different things are still happening with it, and DVDs and stuff. So that part has been amazing, and I'm sure not least because it's not my business, and I never know what to expect, and so, you know, but every day someone will write in saying, I just saw your movie, and here's how it made an impression, or someone that, you know, changed their lives. So it has been very, very cool.
I want to talk about movie making, particularly documentary filmmaking, as politics. Mm-hmm. Robert Greenwood with his, you know, Fox sure. attacks and things like that. Michael Moore with, you know, Roger and Me, and then, you know, Fahrenheit 9/11, and how Who Killed the Electric Car plays into that in right. a sense, or has its role in movie making as politics in a
right.
sense.
Well, I mean, it's fun. I wasn't a producer. I had mm-hmm. no official role in making the film. In fact, you know, the first time I really saw it in completion was at Sundance, and it was a bit of a shock, actually. But it has, I think, become an accepted tool for getting your story out there and for politics. And, you know, I joke that, you know, as we tried to get this story told, we did what you do when you're in L.A. and you get pissed off about something. You make a movie because it's become rather anticipated for people to do that. Mm. But it is difficult. I mean, in the wake of people like Michael Moore, it was tough to get people to participate in this film. And, you know, especially since Michael has made a story about GM, I mean, they were especially reticent. And, you know, we had lots of challenges with people who are willing to tell their story on camera. And in a certain sense, you know, it's an odd thing to hand over your life to someone else to tell anyway. And especially, you know, it was Chris's first film he directed. I mean, no one really knew. There was a lot of trust because it was their story too, and we felt ultimately they'd do right by that story. But it's an odd process when you're not part of that industry. And then especially for CARB and GM and, you know, the oil companies to come and want to tell that story. Mm. I mean, I'm sure they thought they wouldn't be treated fairly. Mm. And a lot of them wouldn't participate because of that. And mm. so, you know, you have to give credit to the people sort of who are, quote, on the other side, who were willing to come in and do it. And a lot of people wouldn't. I mean, one of the hardest things was actually getting people to tell the good stuff. We tried for a while to get early engineers and impact engineers just to tell how what it was like to be part of making something and the good stuff. And they didn't want to do that even. You know, it wasn't, we weren't asking, come trash your company. It was mm-hmm. like, come tell what it was like to be part of changing the world. Mm-hmm. And they still were hesitant. And there were, you know, emails put out through different companies saying, don't participate with
wow.
these people. And that persists a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a challenge. But it has become a valid way to get your story told. And, you know, we tried to make it not too political. The words mm-hmm. Democrat and Republican don't really appear in the movie, mm-hmm. and it was not a partisan thing. It was meant to be nonpartisan.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some interesting conclusions, because we talk a little bit about, you know, Bush and different people in the film, and sort of the obvious conclusion is, oh, Republicans were against it and Democrats are for it. And that's not really the case. I mean, the first two women who led CARB were Republicans, and mm-hmm. they held strong on that mandate and would not give in to the automakers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Democratic guy who eventually came in and gave it away and let them off the hook. So even that, we couldn't draw obvious parallels because they weren't. They didn't exist.
You know, I want to kind of get some of your overall thoughts, in a sense, about where it was, what happened, and where it is now. I mean, here you've just talked about, you know, the partisan angle of it, that it wasn't partisan with the two Republican chairs of CARB, who were very vociferous in it, in their commitment to it, and that a Democrat was the one who ended up killing the mandate. How do you feel about the whole genesis as you look back on it now? You know, I kind of want to just get some of your personal thoughts about it, and, you know, what makes you angry, what makes you excited, you know, and things
yeah.
like that.
Well, I'm the resident optimist in the group. I mean, it comes through, you know, sort of infernally. I can't give that up. So I don't know that a lot makes me angry. Some of it I find sad and frustrating. And you know, there are moments where you get angry. There are moments, really, where you get burnt out. And it does take, you know, a certain something to sort of pull yourself up by the bootstraps and keep doing this for 10 years or however long it's been, and to not give up. I mean, the easiest thing is to give up.
Mm.
But, you know, potential has a palpable sensation to it. And it is impossible to be part of something like that, I think, and stand there at the beginning and actually feel that the sensation of the world changing around you a little bit and what potential that has, and not find it addictive. You know, to see what's possible through that sort of technology and not want to recreate it. And so that's part, I think, of at least what keeps me going. I'm not sure about everybody else. So it's frustrating every time, you know, I use, you know, children as the analogy, but it's frustrating when you watch them stumble and you just want to go, come on, you know, I can help you and you could do better and here's how. And yet you have to let them figure it out along the way themselves. But it has come, I think, full circle, and it's frustrating it took 10 years, but I'm happy to see it happening at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be really unfortunate if we still hadn't learned any lessons from it. And it still requires vigilance. We can't be complacent. You know, I don't want to come back in 10 years and tell another story about plug-in hybrids or something else.
Which you actually refuse to buy.
No, I refuse to buy a regular hybrid.
Excuse me. You refuse to buy a hybrid. Why? You're waiting for the plug.
I am. I'm waiting for the plug. Basically, the hybrids I've seen have not been enough. I think if you have to buy a car today, a hybrid is a very valid choice, no question. And some are better than others. And some really efficient gas cars are really valid choices, too. I mean, the Honda Fit and the Toyota Yaris and the Nissan Versa, we're seeing lots of smaller, more efficient gasoline cars. So it's not that hybrids are the be-all, end-all, but I have used the analogy of you know, accepting C's from your kids when you know they can get A's. And I've been in the companies and I've seen what's possible and what they can build. You know, the plug-in hybrid was supposed to be the follow-up product to the EV1 10 years ago. I mean, I knew what was intended. And so to buy something that's more of a watered-down version of what I know is possible is really tough to do. And the last thing I did before I left GM was to buy another Saturn, and I continue to drive it, and I hope I get to drive it until there's something with the plug, and they know that I want the first Volt, and gosh, maybe the first plug-in view, I'm not sure, but you know, I still support anybody that tries to do better, but I think they can do better than that.
It's interesting because I echo the same sentiment. I mean, I have a 15-year-old car, and it's got 115,000 miles on it, and it's a foreign-made car. It'll go another 100,000 miles. So do I want to have another car payment of $300 a month and an insurance payment of $200 a month for a vehicle that I drive very little?
Right.
I'm very fortunate. I live very close to public transportation, to the train system here in Los Angeles, and I'm very fortunate that I work from home. Prior to this job, though, I was within walking distance of my other job.
Right.
So it didn't make sense for me to go out, even though I salivated all these cars and, you know, I want to buy a new car and I have to, you know, hit myself over the head to say, no, wait until the plug
right.
is coming,
right.
until it's here, which, you know, conceivably is 3 years.
Right. And maybe sooner. I mean, for everybody that already has a Prius, there are, you know, valid conversion options coming. They're not quite here, but early next year. I mean, current Prius owners and some other hybrids will be able to convert their existing
vehicles
to be plug-in hybrids.
Exactly. We work with HiMotion a lot and report on them a lot and the Google initiative and things like that.
So there are things you can do. You can convert your existing gas car to be an electric car and that sort of thing if you are so impatient you don't want to wait.
Go Gadget. Gadget certainly does it. So
right.
Doesn't matter what kind of car it is. Almost any car is capable of being converted.
Very much so.
Well, you know, we've had a wide-ranging discussion here, and I could talk to you for hours. It's very, very exciting and stimulating. I want you to kind of just wrap it up for me in a sense. What excites you right now that you see with current technology, the air car, the Vectrix, you know, we've finally met at the launch of that. We hear about the Volt and the plug-in view. What really excites you right now?
I am more excited by the collective enthusiasm for this technology, for electric drive, than I am by any one product. I mean, there are a bunch of cool products. I mean, the Tesla is wicked fun to drive, and, you know, I love the Volt, and I think that other companies are working on some stuff, too, most of which they haven't made public, but which I know to be very cool. But just the fact that such a broad coalition of people are now talking about this, that we as a society are starting to ask better questions and ask for more information and use that information to make better decisions, both buying and voting, that policymakers are starting to get into this the way that they are, and that, you know, people are starting to respect consumers for their role in all of this, and that consumers are starting to realize their own power. I mean, that's important, too, that, you know, they shouldn't be marginalized for wanting better. And they have been, I think, to this point, and they've started to realize we have to ask for better and refuse to settle for less, or we never will see better in our showrooms. And so that collective enthusiasm and that momentum is what I'm most excited by. You know, it's also incumbent upon us to keep it going. But, you know, that average people can move this, can move an industry, is an amazing thing. And we're just starting, I think, to see that potential.
After leaving GM, you founded Plug-in America, is that correct?
I did. I was a co-founder of Plug-in America. And it was an outgrowth of the people who got together to try to save the different electric cars. And so,
talk a little bit about that organization.
Well, I mean, it's an advocacy group, and it's all about plug-in cars and the fact that electricity is cleaner, cheaper, domestic, and that we consider the integration of electric drive both both as pure electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids to be kind of the killer app.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, plug-in hybrids are the only vehicle technology that can be used with every other fuel out there. You know, your secondary fuel could be gasoline tomorrow and ethanol the next day and biodiesel and all these different things. So it holds amazing potential for, you know, getting us off being quite as dependent on petroleum, for a variety of fuel choices, especially as we start to see regional fuels, you know, renewable diesel in one area, ethanol somewhere else, that kind of thing, and that can be integrated into every sort of vehicle without compromise in performance, in body style, and is, for the most part, much more economical to drive. I mean, electricity is the equivalent of 60 cents to a dollar for gasoline, depending on where you live, and it's something that is very near term, and so, you know, yes, there are people focusing on hydrogen and some other fuels, and they may happen one day, you know, but it's not an either-or scenario. And right now, here is a really tangible action we can take that is very meaningful. We can support 180 million cars without building another power plant.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reason not to go that direction. And so Plug-in America, you know, advocates for that. We work with policymakers, with automakers, with consumers, helping them all understand each of their roles and what's possible. Sort of an information clearinghouse, and, you know, with any luck, we'll get cars back on the road sometime soon.
And so if people want more information about hybrids, plug-in electric vehicles, and the movie Who Killed the Electric Car,
yes.
PluginAmerica.com is a repository for them to go to.
Absolutely.
Great. Chelsea Sexton, gosh, what a great time to sit with you here. Thank you so much for making the trek out here to eastern Los Angeles, the Mount Washington area. I appreciate your time
here today.
Absolutely,
anytime.
For the next year green, I'm Matt Kelly on PodTech.net.